Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money on KPCW on this unusual day that has snow in the forecast. We'll talk about that a little bit later. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and we have a different kind of show today in that it's my last show, Doug.
A different and special show.
We'll see how special it is.
Well, one way or another, it's bound to be special.
Our first guest is Bryce Hoffman, who's on hold on the phone right now from Michigan. He is a writer and a blogger, and you see him on Forbes.com and other places, and has a book out called Red Teaming, which is taking a military concept of leadership training and showing how it can be applied in the business world. So we'll be talking with Bryce Hoffman first.
Yeah, that'll be a fun conversation, and then we're going to tone it down just a little bit. We're going to talk to Polly Rim. She is the manager of Townshend Park City Tea House. Townshend is a tea franchise that started in Portland, Oregon, and we'll talk to her about where she's opened up and the type of services that you can get there, the type of food, beverages that are available there. And then we're going to do a goodbye to Larry Warren. We're going to have the board chairman of KPCW, Bob Richer. We're also going to have Renee Bodley, our new general manager of the station, in with us. And for our last guest, we're just going to have a conversation with Larry about his 46 years in journalism. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's annual summer concerts return to Canyons Village on June 24th and continues throughout the summer on select Saturdays. Live music begins at 6 o'clock and is open to all ages. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, this is Bob Dillon, a lawyer in the Park City office of Jones Waldo with 38 years of legal experience in complex real estate transactions. Proud supporters of KPCW, Jones Waldo provides local businesses with legal services in areas ranging from real estate to employment law. Our website is joneswaldo.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital and New Park Town Center, with new retail spaces and a year-round community development. Information about New Park Town Center is available at 801-303-5440.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. And before we get to Bryce Hoffman in just a moment, interesting weather coming up. We're about at our high today. We're at 59 now. It's only supposed to get to 64 and then start plummeting with rain and possibly snow later today. June is interesting here.
In fact, the forecast says snow likely on Tuesday.
And that's by Tuesday. And that is life at 7,000 feet.
And then back in the 80s by the end of the week.
Yeah. So anything can happen and will. Well, I want to welcome to Mountain Money Bryce Hoffman. Bryce is an author. He's a leadership expert. He gives speeches. He blogs at Forbes.com. Written a couple of books, and the latest is Red Teaming, How Your Business Can Conquer the Competition by Challenging Everything. Welcome to Mountain Money, Bryce.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Doug.
Pleased to have you with us. Let's talk about red teaming. You say this is a concept that grew out of 9/11 in the military, which obviously with everyone else was surprised by the 9/11 attack. What did the military decide it needed to freshen up its thinking about?
Well, it decided that it needed to stop being so complacent about thinking that it had kind of cracked the code and figured everything out, and needed to take a hard look at its strategies, its policies, its way of thinking, and created a system, a comprehensive system, to stress test strategies, to make better decisions, and also to get at the kind of good ideas that are often buried in an organization by the bureaucracy, by the hierarchy, or what have you. And, you know, these, as you said, were born out of the hard lessons of 9/11 and the wars that followed, where the military recognized it made a lot of mistakes. And red teaming was its effort to make sure they weren't repeated again.
And in fact, as we went into Kuwait to, Iraq after 9/11, the assumptions of the military were wrong there, too. You relate the story of of talking to an Iraqi, and his main question was, when are you going to leave once you win?
Yeah, this is kind of the kind of origin story of red teaming in the U.S. Army. Colonel Steve Rotkoff, who created red teaming, the Army's version of red teaming, had this. He was the number two intelligence officer planning the invasion, and just weeks before, the CIA brought in this Iraqi sheikh to meet with them, and he basically schooled them into all the things they had missed. You know, they thought that liberating Iraq was going to be like liberating Paris in 1944. You know, that they explained to the sheikh that, we're going to get you out of your way as quickly as possible, let you rebuild your country. You've got resources, you've got oil, you can get back on your feet. And the sheikh looked at them and said, are you crazy? This is not going to be Paris in 1944. This is going to be post-Tito Yugoslavia. Everyone's going to kill everyone else. And if you guys think you're going to pull out, don't even bother coming in the first place. And that conversation really impacted the colonel. And in 2004, after things had really started to unravel in Iraq, he was one of the leaders of a lessons learned team set up at the Pentagon to make sure this type of thing never happened again. And his idea was, instead of having these conversations when it's too late to do anything about them, create a system to make sure these tough questions are asked ahead of time. And that's what red teaming is designed to do. And my thought is that, this is valuable for the military, but it could be even more valuable for businesses. If you think about business decisions, how many businesses have made decisions that seemed like a great idea at the time, but in retrospect turn out to be just really disastrous?
So let's talk about some of these concepts. So first off, it's called red teaming. That's a military term from way back, way before it's used to describe what it is now. What is a red team traditionally for the Army? And then let's go from there. Just answer the first part, if you would, please.
Sure. So, red teaming goes back to the early days of this idea of military wargaming. And the red team was always the enemy. And the idea of wargaming was that you have one set of officers play the enemy and try to defeat your strategy on a tabletop exercise to make sure to uncover the weak spots in it. In a planning room rather than on the battlefield. And then this concept grew out of that, which has been around for a while, into what the military calls decision support red teaming, which is designed to help organizations make better decisions by breaking their plans and strategies down into the assumptions that they're based on, and then challenging those assumptions to make sure they're really true.
So that's the
red team does.
Yeah, that's the basic concept. Is you have some folks on the other side of the table questioning your assumptions, questioning some of your decisions, so that hopefully you end up as a group making a better decision. As you said, it's a military concept. For many years, they trained officers. In this concept of red teaming, never allowing any civilians in. You say in your book you were the first civilian to be invited to go through as a civilian. You didn't have to enlist to do it. Why did the military invite you to come and experience the red teaming concept?
Well, they didn't invite me. I kept knocking at the door until they finally got so annoyed that they let me in. So after
the mark of a good reporter, by the way.
exactly, Larry. And after my last book came out, I which was about how Ford had saved itself during the global financial crisis, I quit my job as a reporter and began working as a management consultant. And one of the things that I discovered is that, Bill Gates, I think, said it best when he said that success is a poor teacher. And, working with companies, I found that when they're successful, they often feel like they've cracked the code, right? They've figured it out. And this is what happened to the U.S. military, too. We had these easy victories in the first Gulf War, in the Balkans, and that led the military to think they'd cracked the code. And so I was looking for a system that I could teach companies that would help them continually try to do what they do better, because we live in an era of unprecedented complexity and disruption in the marketplace. And that's true if you're a small business. It's true if you're a global corporation. And so the idea behind red teaming and why I wrote this book and why I was so persistent in asking the Pentagon to let me go through this program until they relented was because I think that the whole point here is to disrupt yourself before someone else disrupts you.
great. And in your book, you've got several examples. You just mentioned Ford. You wrote a book on Ford, and it's really the story of Alan Mulally coming in from outside of the industry and really having incredibly impressive results during probably one of the toughest times in the auto industry in the last 75 years. Tell us how being an outsider helped Alan Mulally make the changes he needed to make at Ford.
Well, you know, that is really a great question, Doug, because that goes to the value of red teaming. You know, Alan, as you say, was an outsider. He had been the head of Boeing Commercial Aviation Division. He was an aerospace engineer. And when he came to Detroit, you know, the guys at the top of the house at General Motors and Chrysler were just cracking jokes about, you know, gee, Ford's going to save itself by building a flying car or by bringing back tail fins. You know, I mean, what the hell are they thinking, you know, bringing this guy in, you know, who knows nothing about the auto industry. And yet it was that outsider perspective that allowed him to save Ford, because he wasn't bound by all the groupthink, by all the assumptions, by all the, you know, this is the way things are that everyone else at Ford was thinking. He was able to look at it with a fresh set of eyes to challenge Ford's assumptions. And by doing so, he was able to lead Ford, as you put it, through the most challenging market conditions, actually, in the history of the company, come out as the only American automaker not to go bankrupt, the only American automaker to turn down a government bailout. And it was, you know, really that outsider, that outside questioning, contrarian perspective that allowed him to do that. And that's what red teaming is designed to do, is help leaders have that same perspective in their organization, even if they're not an outsider.
Okay, so let's drill down to what it means on the ground. Say I'm president of Park City Widget Company and I'm drifting right now. How do I red team my problems?
So there's different ways you can use red teaming. If you're drifting, then what you really need to do is get new ideas. So there's tools and techniques that the military has developed. Most of them fall under a rubric of what they call liberating structures, which sounds like an odd term for the military to use. But they're a set of tools that are designed to go into your organization and get at the good ideas and the truth that lies farther down in the organization. It's usually held back by, like I said, a bureaucracy or groupthink or just organizational inertia. So there's tools that you can use to talk to your employees, talk to your team, and get ideas on how to go forward. Then you need to use those ideas to develop a strategy or plan. Red teaming, as I talk about in the book, red teaming is not a better planning process. It's a process to make your plan better. So what I mean by that is that red teams don't design the plan. They can give you good inputs to make a plan, like I just talked about. And then when you have come up with a plan, you can use the really powerful tools in red teaming to stress test that plan to make sure it's really the right plan. And that can be really, really important to do before you execute that plan.
You know, Bryce, Larry used an interesting term. You know, it's Park City Widget Company, and you said, Larry, that if they're drifting, what do they do? And I think a classic example that of a company that was drifting, had some big success but started to drift in a major way. You mentioned it in your book, is Apple Computers, when Steve Jobs came back. Now, that was kind of a Hail Mary pass for the board, right? Kind of, what do we have to lose? It was not obvious at the time that Jobs was going to be a superstar. So I want to go to the decision to bring in an outsider. And at that point, Jobs was an outsider. So in Apple's case, it was a Hail Mary pass. But in Ford's case, the simple answer would have been to bring in another successful auto executive. What do you think it was about the board situation that they were receptive to bringing in Alan Mulally, as we've discussed, an aerospace business person?
Well, it's a simple answer, Doug, because they didn't have a choice. Bill Ford had already tried to offer the position to every rock star in the automobile industry, to Carlos Ghosn, who was so successful that he was not only the CEO of one car company, he was the CEO of two. At the same time, Nissan and Renault. He offered it to Dieter Zetsche, who your listeners may remember as Dr. Z from Chrysler's ad campaign, who was running Chrysler for Mercedes at the time. He had offered it to Wolfgang. He was going to offer it, tried to offer it to Wolfgang Bernhard, who became the CEO of Volkswagen. They all turned him down.
You know, that's
nobody believed that Ford could be saved.
Yeah, I had forgotten that, and I saw it. I work in the financial services business, and I saw that play out in the stock as rumors came out of all these people turning it down. The stock went lower and lower and lower. So that was also a case of not having many choices. Let's use a different example for decision making. You also give the example of New Coke. Many people in the audience remember when Old Coke went away, New Coke came out, and it was amazing how the nation reacted. Tell us that story and how something like red teaming might have been able to help them.
That's a great, great example you picked, Doug, because, you know, New Coke really, the whole Old Coke, New Coke story really illustrates just how complex decisions that businesses have to make can be. So we all remember, you know, or if we're old enough, at least, I guess I'm dating myself, we remember when Pepsi launched the Pepsi Challenge. And the reality was Coke, in its own testing, realized that the Pepsi Challenge was right, that people did prefer the taste of Pepsi to Coke. And so they decided, well, we've got to come up with a new drink that people, you know, tastes better than Old Coke, that people will like. And they set about doing that. They came up with this new formulation that in taste tests, people preferred over Pepsi and Old Coke. And they were mindful. They were mindful of the fact that this was a dangerous gamble, that they were messing with this iconic product that people felt very strongly about. But and a lot of the business analysis that took place after the fact said, well, they didn't ask the right questions. They didn't ask, you know, if people would be happy about replacing Coke. They did. They just didn't listen to the answer. So what they did is they created two different ways of measuring consumer sentiment on this. First, they asked people, they gave people samples of the new drink, they asked them if they'd like it, and they asked those individual people, if we came out with this new beverage, how would you feel about us replacing the Old Coke with this? And they found that a significant percentage, majority of people, said, yeah, I like this better, and I think that'd be fine. But they also did group questions, where they put people in groups and asked them, you know, focus groups, asked them how they feel about changing Coke. And a different thing happened there. Initially, people said, yeah, I like this new taste. I think this is good. But as soon as someone in the group said, you know, Coke is like apple pie. You can't mess with Coke. It's like changing the flag, one executive said. Then people started saying, yeah, that guy's right. You know, why would you do that? Why would you change this? They decided that they were going to go with the results of the individual surveys instead of the group surveys. That was a huge mistake, because what the individual surveys had captured was the fact that even though people preferred the taste of new Coke, and even though when they were asked in private if they would be okay with changing the formulation, when people started talking about it in group, the dynamic changed. And we all know that New Coke didn't last very long. It was a huge disaster, cost the company hundreds of millions of dollars, and is probably one of the worst product disasters in business history. How red teaming could have helped that, there's a whole array of tools and techniques in the red teaming toolkit that are designed to help you evaluate how your customers feel about things, how changing one thing will affect their perception of other things. As one of the generals who's an expert in red teaming that I study with said, complex problems like this are akin to playing chess in a game where all the pieces are connected by rubber bands, so that if you move one, you pull every other piece on the board with it. And that's the type of problem that Coke was dealing with. That's the type of problem red teaming is designed to help companies solve.
You know, there was a story going around at the time that actually it was all a brilliant Coke campaign to prove that people really didn't want to drink a Pepsi-like drink.
That's when you say after you fail and you try to spin it.
That's your CYA explanation of why that bombed. You also talk a little bit about Amazon, and Amazon has it dialed in terms of mass merchandising online, and clearly Walmart missed that boat completely. They were the kings of mass marketing in person, but completely blew it on going online. So Amazon had it dialed in.
Yeah, and you know, when I first heard about this concept of red teaming, Larry, you know, it sounded really powerful to me, but I didn't trust myself to make that decision. So I started sharing this idea with executives that I knew at different companies, and one of them was a friend of mine who's a senior executive at Amazon. And when I told him about these tools that the military had developed, he said, "You know, this sounds a lot like what we do." We don't have it as quite a formal process. We don't call it red teaming. It's just in our DNA. Ever since we were a small company, we've had a culture in which Jeff Bezos has challenged us to constantly question what we're doing, to see if there's a way to do what we do better. And if we and also to look at other industries and see if there's a way to do what they do better. And that's why Amazon has been successful, not just as a retailer, but in all of these other spaces that it's gone into, is because they have this approach of looking and trying to figure out ways to do things better. And they have a system that they use that works well for them. One of the things that the points that I make is this is a similar system that companies who aren't Amazon can use to get that same sort of perspective. You know, and you mentioned the Apple case before too, and I think that's a great example. You know, when Steve Jobs came back into Apple at the time was making more than a dozen different Macintoshes. And he was able to look at it with a fresh set of eyes and say, why are we making all these different computers? You only need four computers. You need a professional desktop, a personal desktop, a professional laptop, a personal laptop. Figure out what the best one is in each of these categories and kill everything else.
The famous two-by-two grid.
Mindset.
Yeah, the famous two-by-two grid, right? We need the best in class for, what was it, consumer and pro and desktop and portable.
Exactly.
Now, you know, that's a interesting case because in Steve Jobs' case, you know, he was really a red team of one. He was the one that was doing this.
And obviously
had a lot of credibility and respect with the workforce. What about a red team with several people? How do they get the respect and the, for lack of a better term, the power to do the role that they need to do to be successful?
Well, you make a great point. I mean, Steve Jobs really was a red team of one. You know, most of us are not Steve Jobs, though. Most companies don't have a Steve Jobs that they can call on to do that. So what red teaming does is that by bringing together a group of people to look at problems in the same way that Steve Jobs did, you can kind of emulate that by bringing together people with diverse backgrounds, with diverse perspectives to look at. Now, how does that work? Well, first of all, the first answer to your question is you need to have buy-in from the top. As I say in my book, red teaming is not for everyone. If you're a company that believes it's already figured everything out and just needs to keep doing what it's doing, and that life is going to be great, you're not going to benefit from a red team. Red teaming is for organizations that know that they can always do better, that there's always room for improvement. If you're not one of those organizations, you can just sit back and wait for your competitors to show you that you're wrong. But there's no point in red teaming if you're not receptive to it. Second of all, red teaming is not a replacement for leadership. So you don't have to sway the employees the way Steve Jobs did. Red teaming simply provides the organization's leadership with another perspective, with another set of information that it can weigh when it makes decisions.
Okay, so the red team is internal employees, or do you need to bring in a consultant or an outsider, a facilitator to figure out where you need to go as a company?
There's a whole array of red teaming models that I talk about in the book that range from simply taking the tools and techniques that I describe in detail in the book and using them yourself just to make better decisions, which is not red teaming formally, but is still valuable, all the way to having a standing red team in your organization, which is probably only something that very large corporations are going to do. In between, one of the things that you can do is you can either have one of your employees get trained as a red teamer so that they can kind of facilitate red teaming inside the organization. That's something that my firm, for instance, provides. Or you can bring in an outside red team facilitator to kind of lead the organization through a red teaming exercise, which is another thing that we do that's very effective.
Well, Bryce, thank you for joining us. We've got to let you go, but before I do, one last question for you, just briefly. You mentioned you went from a journalist, having written multiple best-selling books, to being a business consultant. I'm curious, you know, Larry's the professional journalist. I work in the business industry, and we team up to do this show. I'm curious, as a journalist, you know, I think of the role of journalism as being descriptive, and the role of a business consultant as being prescriptive, prescribing, here's what you should do differently. How do you feel that transition goes from being journalist to business consultant?
So a great question. I mean, one of the things that I realized, and I didn't do this intentionally, I just, you know, after my last book came out, I started getting calls from companies who wanted me to help them implement the ideas in it. And one of the things that I learned is, you know, and this is something I'm sure Larry can echo, is, you know, after you've been a journalist for several decades, you, a business journalist at least, you find that you've been inside hundreds of companies. And you've seen them up close and personally. You've seen what works and didn't work. And that's a perspective that people really find valuable, because most business leaders maybe have been in, you know, three or four companies in their career. So that's one thing. The other thing is just personal, is that when I started working with companies, I found that I enjoyed helping companies solve their problems a lot more than I enjoyed writing about their problems.
Well, that's a great note for us to end on. Thank you for being our guest, Bryce Hoffman. He is the author of Red Teaming, How Your Business Can Conquer the Competition by Challenging Everything.
Thanks for joining
us. Thank you, guys. And Larry, congratulations on making it to this milestone.
Thank you. And you know, one of the things I did freelance was write for Money Magazine and other business publications. So who knows? I may go back to that. Or I may just take a very long vacation.
Bryce, thanks for joining us.
I'm sure you've earned it.
Well, I think so. Okay. Well, we're almost at our high for the day. We're only expecting 64 degrees out of this day and 34 tonight. Depending on where you are, you may want to cover your crocuses, or we're past that season now. Cover your
maybe tomatoes,
your other plants and vegetables, etc. So it's going to get cold, and by Tuesday, we're expecting a rain snow mix. In fact, that could start tonight, but then, you know, wait a day around Utah and it changes, and then by midweek, we're going to be back into summer. So when we come back, we're going to change subjects radically and talk about tea. After this,
All Resort Group is a proud KPCW sponsor of Mountain Money.
All Resort Group provides vans, SUVs, sedans, and Express for Less taxi to move you from Salt Lake to Park City and back, or anywhere you want to go.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, introducing Apex Residences, 63 ski-through community residences located at Park City's expanded Canyon Village, with clubhouse amenities, heated outdoor pool, and in-house concierge. Information at apexparkcity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In studio with us now is Polly Rehm. She is the owner and manager of the Townshend Park City Tea House. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, you know, we have lots of we have several coffee shops.
Right. No, we have lots.
All right. tell us what, you know, we don't, I think you might be the first tea house. What should people expect at a tea house?
So I'm excited to bring a specific tea house to Park City. We, like you said, we have no coffee. We just have tea. We have everything from loose leaf tea to kombucha to bubble tea. We have our own in-house kombucha company called Brew Doctor. We have over 100 different loose leaf teas. We have 11 different chais. We make all of our drinks from scratch. We make our chais with milk, a little honey and a little sugar, so it's not too sweet, not too strong. Probably the best chai you will ever have.
Well, it better be, right? Because that's what you guys do. So you mentioned three or four tea categories when you first started off.
Yes.
I'm not a tea drinker currently, mm-hmm. And there's probably other people in the audience that are much more familiar with coffee just because of the millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars that have been spent in marketing at us. So tell us what those broad categories that you mentioned and what they are.
So for our loose leaf, we have everything from black tea, green tea, white tea, oolong, herbal teas, and then we have an entire apothecary series. Black tea, we have some teas that we can make that's really similar to coffee if people are trying to try and taper off of their coffee. We can make some really great tea lattes with our tea. You still are getting some caffeine, but there's some added benefits to drinking tea instead. Green tea hosts a ton of antioxidants. So it doesn't only taste good, but it's also good for you. Our apothecary series, we have everything from, like, if you have an upset stomach, we have a tummy tamer, or we have, teas to help you sleep at night. We have teas to help with your skin. So there's really a whole gamut of teas to explore.
Okay, so if tea is that beneficial, how come most everybody drinks coffee?
Coffee is actually very popular in the U.S., but tea is like the second drink worldwide to water, which is pretty crazy. So tea is just, I feel like, making its first big appearance in the U.S. You know, it's huge everywhere else. And so I think we're catching on here in the U.S. slowly with all the benefits for tea and what it has to offer. And there's so many different flavors you can get versus coffee. You know, you have a really great cup or a really bad cup.
Yeah, and so your firm is called Townshends.
Yep.
And that's a franchise, if I'm not mistaken. Started in Portland, Oregon, is
that
correct?
So, yeah, it did start in Portland, Oregon. It's not a franchise. It's more of a co-ownership. I went to Townshends last year and pitched to them. I said, Park City really needs a tea house. We have nothing like this here. And we decided to move forward. And so instead of me paying a huge franchise fee up front, my investment was my time and effort into this pretty much the entire last year. So I had to go up to Portland and train from July to, I didn't get back to Park City until Thanksgiving. So I was training at all the different tea houses up there, learning as much as I can from the ground up, and then started the lease process in Park City around Thanksgiving.
Which is not trivial in
right.
itself.
Yeah.
So where's your location?
So we are in New Park. So we're kind of near Best Buy, Indigo Highway, My Liquid Garden, right in that area. And so it's a pretty nice spot in the community. There's really good foot traffic, and it's kind of nice for the locals. It's easy to get to, and yeah.
So Polly, let me, it's an unusual business model that mm-hmm. you have where it's co-owned, the term that you used. Have they done this throughout the country? Are you one of the first? Are you like a beta idea for them to try it out?
So the Park City location is the 9th location, but only the 2nd out of Oregon location. So the first out-of-Oregon location is in Bozeman, Montana. So that was kind of the guinea pig of branching out into other states. It went really well. And so when I went to them last year, they were excited to continue this process and get another location in Utah.
We're a business show, so I'm just curious on the business standpoint,
yeah.
if you don't mind me asking a question or two. Mm-hmm. So did you know about the Bozeman arrangement, that this was a co-owned? Or did you just approach them and then find out they had a program like that?
So I've been wanting to do this for a while, and the Bozeman location opened in 2014. And so the timing was kind of right. They had, you know, 2 years under their belt of trying this location out of Oregon. And so I actually went to school in Bozeman. And so I knew that there was a tea house up there. I didn't know until I pitched it to Townshends how that ownership worked. So once I got into it and learned about it.
Good for you. I love the tenacity. and Townshend must have loved it as well, because clearly you were passionate about opening a tea house, and in particular Townshend's, because
right.
you pursued them.
I did. So I've been watching the company grow over like the past 11 years. I've lived in Utah for 11 years, and I'm originally from Oregon, so that's how I kind of knew of the company. Everything in my life kind of lined up this past year. I used to work at Ramp Sports for the past 6.5 years, helped run that. And when Ramp went up for sale, transitionings were happening, and so I decided if I wanted to do this, now was the time. And so I went up to Oregon and pitched it, and we all agreed that it was a good idea to try, and I trained.
Well, I love that. You don't know unless you try.
And yeah, exactly.
I love the fact. So did you just call up, and who did you meet with initially? I'm curious.
So I called up the owner. I know him through my brother-in-law, and tried to set up a meeting with him just over the phone, and we had a few phone calls, and then I wanted to pursue it further, so I bought a plane ticket and flew up to Oregon and met with them, and basically I wanted to make it so, like, make it happen, and I didn't want to leave until we could figure out how to do it.
Okay, Polly, I'm looking at your tea menu, and it's rather daunting. It goes 20 pages, and the teas are numbered from 1 to 84, and then you get to the apothecary side, and the tonics are numbered or labeled A to X,
right.
Not quite Y and Z, but they're probably coming in a future edition. So how in the world do you know even what to order? I presume you will guide a customer through the selection.
So that's one of the difficulties we face when people come in. You know, a tea house, it's really cool, it's welcoming. But then you look at the menu and you're like, oh my gosh, where do I even start?
Just give me number one.
I just want a green tea. What do I do? So we have some great tea tenders that work at the tea house. Before we opened, we had like a week and a half to taste pretty much all of the teas we offer. We went through the entire menu, so we are all equipped with the knowledge to share with people that are new to the tea world. We can get them a drink that is absolutely tasty and start the process, and then as people progress trying different teas, we can kind of help, you know, new areas, or if you've never tried like an oolong tea, we can help you.
And it's priced as loose tea by the ounce, and it's $3 to $10 an ounce. Most of them are in the $3 to $5 range.
Right.
So is an ounce the amount you brew?
No. So the way the pricing is in the menu, it is by the ounce. So we can sell all of our teas by the ounce. So that's the pricing that you're seeing. So you can come in, if you have a tea that you really enjoy, we can package it up for you. We put directions on the bag of how to brew it. For an ounce of tea, if you're brewing at home, you can get 8 to 10 cups out of that. But if you're coming into the tea house, we can prepare drinks, 12 ounces, 16 ounces. So you can enjoy either in the tea house or you can take it to go. And those prices range from like $2 to like $7.
So, you know, going to a coffee shop or going to a tea shop often is more than just about getting the beverage, right? It's the ambiance, it's hanging out, it's the free Wi-Fi. Tell us what that situation is like. Do you have lots of seating available for folks? Are they welcome to hang out for 45 minutes or an hour
if they want? Absolutely. Yeah, we have, the space I chose is around 1,500 square feet, so it's big. We have probably 45 seats in there. We have some couches. We have some big comfy chairs. So it's kind of like you're walking into like someone's comfy living room, grabbing a cup of tea and hanging out.
I mean, that's the beauty of a coffee shop and a tea house is it's much more of an experience than just what you're drinking. All right, well, we need to let you go, unfortunately. Polly, today is Larry's last day, and we kind of a going away guest spot coming up next. Our guest has been Polly Rehm. She is the owner and manager of Townshend's Park City Tea House, which is over at New Park. If you go to Best Buy, you'll see it from there.
Right there, yep.
Polly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch Counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Larry, you and I have known the last show was on the horizon probably for the better part of a year. It has snuck up on us. It's definitely bittersweet. This is the last segment of the last show.
Bittersweet for who?
I'm glad to hear that. That's how it should be. In studio, joining us now is the chair of the board of directors of KPCW, Bob Richer. Bob, good morning.
Morning, Doug.
And we also have KPCW's new general manager, Renee Bodley. Renee, welcome.
Thank you, Doug. Hi, Larry. Hi, Doug. Hi,
and,
Bob.
And I think this is the perfect time to announce who the new co-host of Mountain Money is.
Yeah,
do you know?
Well, it's not me.
We know it's not Bob.
I thought we were going to surprise you with that. Yeah,
yeah, well, we were going to talk with Renee afterwards. I'm assuming by that intro that Renee has said yes, and she'd like to be the new co-host, which is awesome.
Hi. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun to be here on Monday mornings. No one can fill Larry's shoes. And, Doug, I'm looking forward to sitting next to you and talking to our listeners about all the great new business developments that are happening out there.
Well, see, we were going to talk about this afterwards, but I thought if I just announced it on the air, she couldn't say no.
That was very smart.
All right, clever.
You're locked in now, Larry. All right, so Larry, you let me know the other day, 46 years of time as a broadcast journalist. That's amazing.
Yeah, I started as a student intern as soon as school got out in 1971, I guess. And then the place I interned with, which was Channel 4 in Salt Lake, hired me, and that was the start of, 46 years, starting in June.
Tell us how you arrived in Salt Lake City. What brought you to the area? I think you spent your early years in Wisconsin.
In the Midwest, and wanted to ski, and needed to come someplace where I could go to school and ski. Of course, folks, I just told them it was all about the quality of the school. But I went to Denver U and majored in business for 2 years, and those were times of upheaval in and Denver U was on strike more than we were going to class. And after 2 years there, I decided I really need to get somewhere at college, and I'd been in the business school, and I decided my heart was really in journalism, and they didn't have a journalism school, so the search was on for the school that was closer to skiing and had a 2-year journalism degree. So I came over and finished up at the U of U and just fell in love with Utah, which in the early 70s was really an unknown, unsung place.
In many ways, still is. You know, after 46 years, one of the things when I first started co-hosting with you is almost anything I would mention to you that, you know, hey, this interesting thing happened, or I saw this on the news, you'd say, oh, yeah, I interviewed that person, or I know the CEO.
You know,
the one that sticks in my mind is I remember once the Oscar Mayer Wiener truck was up at Deer Valley, and I told you. Over the weekend, you asked me what was going on. I said, oh, I hung out at the Oscar Mayer Wiener truck. And you told me you interviewed Oscar Mayer Jr.
I knew Oscar Mayer.
Yes. I was like, oh, my goodness. All right. So he truly does know everybody.
Oscar Mayer is based in Madison, Wisconsin. I spent a couple of years doing TV news there. And that's what, and Renee can back this up. The coolest thing about journalism is, well, A, serving the public. Every day you're informing the public, giving them information they need to know, like what's on Oscar Mayer's mind. Not really. But it's something different every day. And the life experiences of 46 years of everything from being in the Oval Office with the President of the United States to hanging out with the Dalai Lama. You know, you go to work and not know what you're going to do that day. And one day you walk in and they say, how would you like to follow the Dalai Lama around all day? And you go, well, yeah, I think I could do that.
Well, Larry, what was radio like and then TV 46 years ago? And then what changes have you seen that have been positive and what are negative? And where does that kind of fit in with KPCW?
Well, you know, In the beginning, there was more local ownership, and I worked for Channel 2 for the longest time, and Channel 5 was owned by the LDS Church, so it was locally owned. So you had these two locally owned television stations that really took localism seriously. They were interested in making money, but they weren't interested in squeezing every dime out. I mean, at Channel 2, under local ownership, we did the craziest things that made no economic or business sense, but we still did them because it was localism. And Salt Lake became known in those 70s and 80s years as one of the best television markets in America. It was phenomenal what we were doing here and the places we were going and the stories we were covering, the news we were breaking out of little old Utah, the whole Downwinders story where southern Utahns were poisoned by radiation and dying. That was generated by Channel 2 and the Deseret News. Being on blockbuster stories like that and being given the time to do it was just amazing. Now, as the years went on, everything gets bigger and everything gets reduced to spreadsheets. And in the end, I think we're probably five or six owners removed from the Hatch family, the local Salt Lake family that owned Channel 2 then. And that's the way of the world. Radio, the same way. The radio chains have hundreds of stations now nationwide, and it's so homogenous, which is what makes KPCW so much different from radio today, because we live and breathe localism every minute.
Well, let's talk about that. You know, what makes KPCW different? And Larry, the four of us, Bob Hendricks Hendrickson is our producer, is in the studio as well. Larry, you've recruited everybody that's in the room today, saying thank you and saying goodbye. So, Renee, I'm curious, when Larry pitched you on joining KPCW, and Bob, I'm going to ask you the same question as well, what was it about what's going on here at KPCW that made you say, I want to be part of Larry's team?
Just the total involvement in the community, the fact that we are the community's bulletin board, the community voice, the public service that comes along with public radio. Larry articulates that better than anyone, and he knows the world I came from, which was television news. I was also in the Salt Lake market for 21 years at Fox 13, and there is such a world of difference between for-profit broadcasting and nonprofit broadcasting. You won't see anybody else covering Summit County Council the way Rick Bruff does. One could argue that maybe it's not economically feasible, but it works here because we're nonprofit and we've got generous donors in our community who recognize the importance of our coverage of local news and information. So Larry pitched me on that. I was sold. I'm a journalist by trade. I'm all about the importance of journalism and the Fourth Estate's role in a vibrant democracy, and that's what we do here at KPCW better than almost any other place I've seen.
And how about you, Bob? You are a very well-known figure here in town, very involved. Had gotten the Citizen of the Year award back in the day. Also, what was it about KPC? You're busy in a lot of not-for-profits. What was it about KPCW that wanted you to help out in a meaningful way?
Well, I was actually approached by some of the board members at that time, but I've known Larry as an acquaintance for years.
We arrived within 2 months of each other in 1980, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And I knew Larry's wonderful wife, Carol, and Larry always made presentations to the Rotary Club and so forth, and he's just such a great presenter and such a fun guy, and I always really respected and admired Larry. So just the opportunity to be involved with Larry and the station was something that I didn't want to pass up. And I didn't pass out, and I thought it'd be a great board to get involved with because as a former elected official, I was always very much aware that having interviews with Blair and Leslie, you could speak on your own behalf, and there wouldn't be any filter that you would find sometimes in the written media. And also, I always felt KPCW and the work that Rick Bruff did covering city council and county. county commission meetings were really second to none. So in my mind, it was an A1 enterprise for many, many years. And prior to Larry's arrival, they went through sort of a rough patch. And, you know, my motivation for getting involved was also to try to get them back to where they were in the heyday. And I think with Larry at the helm, we've done that and then some.
Well, Bob, you mentioned passing out. My Larry Warren story almost does involve passing out. Larry and I had been a guest on Mountain Money a couple times talking about the stock market. The market would go up or down. Larry would have me come in. Larry and Pam Wiley at the time,
yeah,
talk about why did that happen. And I casually mentioned to Larry, hey, you know, if there was ever a co-host opportunity for that show, I really like Mountain Money. I'd be interested in doing that. And it was like 3 weeks later, Larry called me and said, well, actually, Pam's going to be stepping down. How would you like to be the co-host? And I had a speech impediment as a child. So I mentioned that I'd like to do it, but I never really thought the opportunity would come up. And my palms literally started sweating. So, Larry, I thank you at the thought of actually doing it. So I thank you for giving me the shot. We've only got like 4 minutes left, Larry. I want to give the last bit of airtime to you.
Well, I just want to thank you for stepping up, and you've been a stellar co-host. And when I don't know the subject, I'll just throw up my hands and point at you, and you'll always fill the time with something intelligent. And Bob, you came onto the board when we were having a hard time recruiting board members. I mean, we were down to five or six, and the station was in rough financial shape, and we were trying to figure out how we could turn it around, and there weren't that many people stepping up, and you stepped up, and as a board leader, as president of the Board of Trustees, you've done just a marvelous job. We're up to about a dozen board members now, and everybody pitches in, and your leadership there has made a difference, and I really appreciate that. And Renee, you're the perfect candidate. We did a nationwide search, and you know, we kind of suspected we had the candidate in-house already with you, but we did a nationwide search anyway to confirm that, and we did find a few. Well, we found that 30 people really wanted the job, because running an NPR station in a ski town, I mean, that's about a dream job if you're a broadcaster and a skier. So there was a lot of interest, but in the end, it came down to you. But we know after a nationwide search, we did get the best person. So I appreciate all of you and the staff of KPCW. It's just amazing, and have made the job so much easier, and you're inheriting a good staff.
And there are a lot of people out there, Larry, whose lives you've touched. I have an email here from J-Dub. A lot of people who are so grateful to you for your service to the community and to the station. And if anyone out there would like to come by the station this Friday from 1 to 3, we are having an open house. So you can see Larry in person and thank him in person, and we'll have some treats around. So come by 1 to 3 this Friday afternoon.
Ooh, that's breaking news. I better put that in my calendar.
I should have checked to see if you were free.
We thought Ethel had already checked with you.
Very
Larry
nice.
Won't be here. But
okay,
if,
well, let's take... Let's,
no, Larry will be here.
We'll have a cardboard cutout.
Let's take care of business. I want to thank the great sponsors who have sponsored the whole strip of public affairs shows Monday through Friday and the local news hour, and specifically the sponsors for Mountain Money that have kept us on the air this long are Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo, Holbrook and McDonough, All Resort Express, Park City Mountain, and Apex Residences and Viridian Park City, Columbus Pacific Properties. Also, thanks to Bryce Hoffman, author of Red Teaming, and Polly Ream, the manager of Townshends in the Park City Tea House down at New Park. So thank you all, and sure appreciate the last 7 years here at KPCW. It has been fabulous. Thank you all.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
And for the last time, I'll say this is...